It's a beautiful morning.
That picture of all
the
group.
Of the three of you.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I think that's interesting. You know, how many women are actually involved in research there and treatment at the hospital clinic?
Well, in our department, most of staff are women. Probably in our institution, IDIPAPS, I think around 70% of workers are women, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I was going to talk about that later, but it's a good intro because we have in America a program called STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, for women to promote young girls and young women to get into the sciences. But obviously here, it's already happened well.
Yeah. When I was at university, the most of our students, we were women. But what we found now at practical, doing research every day, is that as workers, there are mostly women. But in the as a leader of groups, the percentage of women is less than men. So this is the complete equality.
Right. And it's something that has to be, we'll talk about that definitely when Begonia comes on, because I think it's an important thing, but I think it's wonderful that you get 70% of the women already there.
Yeah.
How did you focus on male cancer, prostate cancer? What was the interest for you in doing that?
I have a personal motivation since my father was affected of prostate cancer, but this is a very common disease, and the profile of patients are really kind and really nice. And this is a slow growing disease in general, not in the whole cases, I wanted to do research in cancer, and I had the opportunity of focus on this disease, and I was really interested in
and
that.
And since we had a close family relationship, it just made that more compelling.
Exactly.
That's good.
Yeah.
We'll be back to talk more with our guests right after this. And that was São Paulo by Rick Braun and Richard Elliott. Now, we're talking here with Dr. Marina Aguilera and about research. Now, the fact that, you know, you both are involved in research and treatment of prostate cancer, is this condition significant here in Catalonia?
Oh, yes, it is. Prostate cancer is the second most common frequent tumor diagnosed in men, and the fourth in general population. And the diagnosis has been increased during the last years because we have been improved. We have improved in our techniques for diagnosis, so it makes that the incidence now is bigger. But it also helps to make an early diagnosis.
Always.
But this is a significant problem here.
Now, when we talk about, you know, the incidence of cancer, like you're saying, it's the second most diagnosed cancer.
Yeah.
Is it that we have more cancer now in the society, or are we just doing a better job of finding the cancer?
I think both. Our habits or the way as we live now make that the incidence of cancer is growing, but also we are improving a lot in our techniques for diagnosis, so it also allow us to diagnose early this disease and in much more cases than 10 years or 20 years before.
Well, obviously, you know, we have the PSA test, which is a big thing in terms of a simple test that can indicate whether there's a problem or not in the prostate. But now we have even more tests, the urine test, and we have genetic marker tests.
Yeah.
Is this something that's well utilized here? Do men, you know, go to their doctors regularly and say, oh, yeah, be certain I have the PSA test, or is it still a fight to get men to do this?
We think that the tendency of men to worry about their health it's been improved, is increasing. The tendency, the passive attitude of men in terms of physician attendance, and I think is changing with new generations.
We think, are we seeing more younger men becoming more active than, say, older men?
Sure. I think so. Every day, we are, in general, populations take much more care about themselves, I think, that in terms of diet and healthy habits, sport, no?
Right.
I think in my father, for example, and she never practiced any sport. I think nowadays it's strange that young men doesn't do a sport, or women.
Right, right. Well, now you talked a little bit about, you know, the things that cause cancer. You said that, you know, obviously we have things like environment and our lifestyle, you know, how we eat. What are some of the things that you're seeing as a researcher that either are causing cancer or you're maybe accelerating the cancer, you know, making it grow faster?
Yeah, both. I think there are genetic factors that increase the risk of having cancer, and you cannot control that. In case of prostate cancer, this is the minor risk. But it exists, and even we don't know the specific molecular alteration of that brings that
makes the cells become cancerous.
Exactly, but there is a familial risk. If a man have a brother with a prostate cancer disease, he had a 10% more risk of having the disease. So the genetic risk factors exist.
So if the father had it, it's even higher than the 10%.
Even higher, exactly. If there is three relatives in a family with prostate cancer, it increases a 40% risk of having it. Yeah, it exists, but it's not the most...
Not common.
Exactly, the most common.
Okay, but now also because of, we talk about genetics, we've seen that if a man's mother has had breast cancer, it increases his risk of prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's true, because both of them are hormonal diseases. And, well, at the end, they share a hormonal control. Then it can have influence. And they are not totally independent, these kind of tumors.
No, I think, and again, but you know, we talk about we talked a little bit about genetics. We've hit on the fact of, you know, familial and hereditary factors. What are some of the lifestyle factors? You know, what part of our diet is not good for us?
Yeah. Well, the top risk factor in prostate cancer is fat. Eating habits are dangerous. One should take account about
kind of fat that we have, the kind of fat we have in our diet. So
exactly, fat, the obesity and hypertension increase the risk of prostate cancer.
Hypertension as well. So if our blood pressure is high, it can raise
exactly, and all of them are related. I mean, obesity is related with hypertension. So and okay. Also
what about stress? What is stress a factor?
Well, there is not strong evidence about that, but stress it could be related with a lack of functionality of immune system. So, and it also can favor that tumor cells can grow, but there is not experimental strong evidence of that.
Okay, so now if we look at, you know, fat, you know, when we say, we tell people we want to reduce fat, obviously there are things like bacon or maybe red meat. But again, you know, here we have jamon.
No.
And I don't know that I can really walk away from jamon yet. So
yeah. Overall, industrial products, the kind of fat that they have, it's not very healthy.
Like the processed foods.
Exactly. Like, right. Of course, oil... olive oil is really healthy, and this is fat. But the kind of fat that you can eat, it depends on the product.
Okay. Yeah. Now, also, we've seen things like sugar can sometimes turn to fat.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So we should have a low sugar diet as well, then, right?
Well, I'm not really an expert on that, but it could be true. I mean, on excess, we don't need as much sugar as we usually eat, and then at the end we storage this sugar and it becomes fat. Okay. And it.
Well, I know the things we look at. You know, you talk about processed food. You know, industrial products. A lot of them have a lot of sugar in there for taste.
Yeah.
And salt and everything. So you get, you know, the sausages or whatever, and you get processed foods.
We don't realize, but we eat much more sugar than we can imagine.
I think so, because, again, it's not just going to the movies and getting that huge cup of soda.
Or exactly. Sugar drinks.
Yeah, it's more than that. Yeah. Now, when we start looking at then... even though genetics are a small part of the things that contribute to cancer's growth, we're doing a lot more research in terms of genetics. We're trying to find those genes that either cause cancer or can accelerate cancer, you know, particularly.
This is not our main line of work, but there are a lot of groups studying about that. Each tumor is different, and the genetic causes and a lot of genes could be altered and mutated and originate tumors. So every tumor is a different field to study. So in prostate cancer, there is not, well, we know some genes that are really important. If they are mutated, there is a high risk of developing cancer. But there is still not, prostate cancer is really heterogeneous.
Okay.
So at the end, there is not only one alteration or one gene that can originate prostate cancer for sure.
Well, I think the thing we're seeing, I know in the States particularly, we're seeing, you know, what's called variants of the, like, the androgen receptor. So the big thing now is the V7 variant of the androgen receptor.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us about what is the androgen receptor? And I know for women, the estrogen receptor is also important. So what are these receptors and what do they do?
Exactly. Androgen receptor, well, is a molecule that that works in the cell regulating the transcription of genes. And this is specifically, it works specifically in prostate cancer. So this receptor is depending on hormonal of testosterone. Mm-hmm. They are specifically hormones of men. Mm-hmm. So this is because when this receptor is hyperactivated, makes its functionality is really active, and then the division of cells is uncontrolled.
Okay.
Since this receptor at the beginning is depending on hormones in men, the main treatment historically it has been the castration. Okay. Castration means restricting the production of hormones,
right.
Masculine hormones
in men. And testosterone
then,
as well.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Then the tumor usually responds really well and stop growing, and it works. However, tumors escape from this blocking therapies, right. And there is what we call a tumor plasticity, that it's the adaptation of tumor cells to growth despite you are blocking any signaling. So this is the main line of our research, trying to understand why patients respond to treatments and why patients that are theoretically similar, they don't respond. There are differences. And why some of them change how this plasticity works and make that patients that initially respond stop this response.
Well, I think the thing's very interesting about cancer. It's a clever beast in that, you know, it'll all of a sudden you can do something to it and it'll stop. But then it finds out what's happening and it reformulates itself to reject that drug and then starts to grow again.
Exactly. It usually happens. It's like a tumor. The tumoral cells becomes more naive.
Mm.
We call it undifferentiated cells, and it gives them more power to growth and to modify their molecular regulations just because they want to grow. They want to to invade, and this is the only. There is an uncontrolled division.
Right. Well, interesting. We'll be back to talk more with our guest right after this. Thank you. And that was My Mood with MFSB. Nice group, kind of like a nice California sound, just kind of keep us going here. But we're talking a little bit with Dr. Marian Aguilera about cancer, prostate cancer specifically, and research. Now, one of the things that you've talked about is immunotherapy. What is immunotherapy?
Well, this is a kind of treatment that which aims to stimulate immune system of the patient. This is the therapy by itself does not attack the tumor, but it stimulates the immune system to recognize the tumor as something bad and to attack it.
So basically, it's trying to make the body work to fight
exactly.
the cancer.
Our immune system is ready to block the abnormal growing of cells, and it works on that. But the tumor escapes from this immunovigilance, and with this treatment, we want to stop this blocking by. Well, we want to cut this barrier between tumor and immune system and allow it to attack and eliminate this tumor.
Okay, it was interesting because when I had my prostate cancer, I had already been practicing with a Chinese doctor, Chinese medicine doctor.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to her and I said, you know, I've just been diagnosed with prostate cancer. You know, is there anything in the Chinese medicine system that can work? She said, well, we don't have anything that can cure cancer, but we have some things that will help your immune system fight the cancer. And then once you have your treatment, there are things we can do to help you rebuild the system.
Exactly.
So the concept of immunotherapy is not really new. It's been around for a while.
It's new, exactly. But not the whole tumors can benefit from this kind of treatment, since the immune system is not always penetrating tumors. Mm. And so if we don't have immune cells surrounding the tumor, it's not useful that we can stimulate these cells. So it's not working everywhere in cancer, in all tumors. Mm. But nowadays there are a lot of studies in different diseases that are demonstrating in which specifically type of tumors it works well.
Now, is there a test that can say whether our immunosystem is likely to respond to immunotherapy?
Exactly. Well, not in prostate cancer, but there are huge advances in breast cancer, for example. Mm. In our institution, Dr. Alex Pratt, who is the lead of the department, of medical oncology department, he's the lead of also the research team in breast cancer, and they recently published a study where they observe in different tumors that it depends on the molecular characteristics, the tumors are going to respond better or worse to immunotherapy.
Interesting. Now, we talk about things like immunotherapy is designed to kind of enhance the good tumor cells or the good cells that fight the tumor. Chemotherapy is kind of different in that you're killing cancer cells, but you're also killing a lot of other cells too.
Yeah, because chemotherapy usually is focused on block the cell division, and since tumor cells are continuously dividing, they are really prone to be affected by chemotherapy. However, there are other healthy cells in our body that need to be divided
to keep growing,
regenerate our tissues, so they also become affected. Hmm. And this is because there are important secondary side effects of these treatments. But the main tissue affected is those that are continuously proliferating, and these are tumors.
Usually the
so
cancer cells.
This
that
is
are...
because it, chemotherapy works really well.
Okay, now obviously one of the things that you do in research is obviously try to find things that can impact on the cancer cells or either to stimulate the immune therapy. A lot of that has to do in terms of developing drugs. What, in your research, I mean, how do you start to work on developing a drug that's going to fight prostate cancer, for example.
Yeah, well, sometimes when we analyze the molecular profile of tumors, we realize that there are sometimes specific alterations that can, for example, we are studying a specific translocation that it's present in 50% of prostate cancer tumors. Mm. And when this alteration is exists in the tumor, patients respond worse to chemotherapy. Mm. So what we wanted to, one of our projects consists of make a comparison of the molecular profiles between tumors that have this alteration in comparison with tumors that they don't have this alteration. And we wanted in those patients that have this alteration and they don't respond really well to this treatment, look for other targets, other alterations that could be common and that we can act against.
Okay, well now, the process, you know, people say, oh, okay, guys, you guys are sitting there playing with your test tubes and everything. But it's not that simple. I mean,
it's
obviously,
not that simple.
You know, you've got to have a certain number of samples.
Exactly.
You know, so how many, I mean, starting with that, how many samples do you start with just to be able to start identifying those?
Yeah, we need a very important number of sample tumors to work with. But we usually do a translational research. That means that we also we account with cell line models in the laboratory that they become originary from patients, but now they can grow in artificial conditions,
right.
And they are called cell cultures. And then we can make experiments with them as many as we want, since they are not
right.
suffering anything.
Right.
We can try new treatments against them, combinations, and that. But it's really important that the knowledge that is generated in these models, we can apply them to patients. What's happening really in patients? Then we usually, it's really important for us to working with sample patients with tumor, then we can observe the heterogeneity, the real heterogeneity of the disease, and then evaluate if our hypotheses are working well in real life, patients.
Well, then you know, obviously it starts with the developing the cultures and you're seeing how the cultures act, and then you will then take those cultures and you'll put them in mice and see how it reacts in the mice.
Exactly. In fact, we are starting a new project this year. I was awarded a grant, an European grant, for learning how to make mouse models with tumor tissues from patients. This strategy has been widely used in cancer research, but specifically in prostate cancer, it's not an easy to do model.
No.
So in Australia, they are really experts on that. Mm. And well, if hopefully I will go there to learn how to do it and just to set up these models in at hospital clinic.
And the thing is that, you know, people talk about, you know, mouse models. It's not like the mouse you might catch at home or whatever. I mean, these are like special kind of mice that have been bred.
Exactly.
For research purposes, and there are many different kinds of mice that are necessary.
They are really different. In our case, it's important that the mice models have their immune system
similar to, and stable and stable and similar to the patient.
Depressed. They should be immunocompromised,
right?
Because if not, they are going to reject the tumor cells that we are implanting. Mm-hmm. Implanted. So we in prostate cancer we need these kind of models, and well, let's see how it works.
And they're not cheap either.
No, they are expensive. Working with them, they also have to grow in a very controlled in rooms that are pathogen free.
Right.
And well, they have there are a lot of ethical procedures for working with that. I mean, we are not doing anything. We are not doing bad things.
Right.
We try not to make them to suffer. Just they help us to
be able to see how the cells will grow, and that'll be able to give us ideas in terms of how it's going to happen in patients.
Exactly.
Well, we'd like to talk about patients a little bit more right after this. And that was Rodney Franklin with The Groove. Now, we've just been talking about, you know, some of the elements of research. And we talked about, you know, the developing the subcultures as part of slides and petri dishes and tubes and all of that, and then going into mice. But then we have to get into translational research, moving from the lab to more of almost a bedside approach where we have to involve patients. So what is the next step for that? When once we've looked at the mice and we see indications that something might work, how do you then get patients involved?
Exactly. First of all, we have to select those patients that we can address or hypothesis. Then it's really important the collaboration of patients to participate in our studies. So we usually perform observational studies in terms to, well, just to see if our hypothesis that were obtained by cell cultures and more laboratory experiments, they work well on the clinics.
Mm.
So this is because it's very important. Well, usually the physicians explains to the patients our studies and offer them to participate with us. Often they don't have to do anything, just to let us to access to their samples that are usually collected for normal assistants.
Anyway, right.
Exactly. So for us, these biological samples are really, really important. And they reflect the real biological process of the disease. Sometimes it's also important to have a sample in different stages of the disease. So this is because we usually offer to patients to participate actively in these research projects.
And we need to do that because, as we talked about, the cancer changes. So the way the cancer might start off, you know, if you hit it with a drug and it all of a sudden changes,
exactly.
You want to see how it's changed and see.
Exactly. It's really interesting to contrast how was the tumor before treatment and how is it after treatment, because there are changes because of the treatment. And then these the comparisons among or between different, before and post treatment give us a lot of information. Also, the comparison between tumors from different tumor profiles, different molecular types, also let us know differences, and also the correlation with the clinical evolution of patients is really important.
Well, I think, you know, it starts off from the standpoint, you know, you've got in the subcultures and the cell lines, you can see certain characteristics of the variations that the cancer causes. And then you start to look at, you know, population comparison to see, all right, what are the various genetic changes that have occurred over it. And then you look to see, all right, can we then, are there certain patient groups that we have in our biorepository that reflect these same mutations? So we see that, all right, 60% of the patients that we see coming in here, you know, have this particular characteristic. And then we say, all right, well, we've developed now a drug that we think can begin to fight this.
Exactly.
So then you start into various phases of further investigation. So why don't you tell us about that?
Exactly. Sometimes we find new targets. So we have thanks to the collaboration of the industry, they help us to create new chemicals that could affect these new targets. However, nowadays we have a wide spectrum of therapies. And we usually work trying to combine and just to select the appropriate treatment for each patient. It's not that obviously one treatment is not working for all patients, but we have a lot of treatments. It's just the point to select which treatment works with which specifically patient. Or our hypothesis is that combining these treatments instead of giving them alone, maybe they could be more efficient, effective.
So it starts off with what's called a phase one trial. What is phase one? I mean, it's called a toxicity trial. You want to see, all right, you know, can the patient...
Oh, phase one. Yeah. In phase one trials, we try to see to check out that the secondary side effects are not really important. Also, they usually includes patients that are in advanced stages of the disease, and at the same time we are collecting information about the how the disease is responding to this treatment. But what it's observed mainly is that this new treatment is not doing
harm to the patient.
Severe right. Side effects.
Right. So we call it toxicity. Can the patient stand it?
Exactly. You know, well,
can they tolerate it well? Can they? And then does it have an effect on the cancer at the same time?
It's really important to combine to long the survival, but also the quality of life.
Now, from that standpoint, once we kind of know whether it works and it doesn't have any major side effects, we have then a phase two trial.
Yeah. In phase two trials, the effectivity of the treatments wants to be demonstrated. So they include a very higher population, and they want to compare to see which is the benefit in several cases.
Right. So this time, you know, we're looking at, you know, seeing what dose we need to have, whether it's, 5 milligrams, 10 milligrams, whatever, and then, you know, what's the frequency?
Exactly, to adjust these type of things. Yeah.
And then we go to a phase three trial.
Yeah, three trials. We want to compare with treatments that are given nowadays. So they usually have two arms. We say arms, the two options, just to compare if we are improving the current treatments.
Mm-hmm. Well, the two arms, and again, it's a case where the arms are usually attesting like the new drug or the new chemicals that you think can work against what's called the standard of care. So that,
exactly.
You know, again, the patient is getting the appropriate treatment.
Exactly.
So either one arm, he's getting the regular standard of care, or in the other arm, he's getting the new treatment to see how well that works.
Exactly.
So it's not a case where in a placebo trial, he's either getting something or nothing. It's not a case. In this case, we see that they're getting something.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
which is good. So from that, I mean, when you start looking at, you know, the patients, we need a lot of patients to be able to do these trials.
There is a statistical studies behind all of these studies.
Right.
We need to evaluate, first of all, how many patients do we need to demonstrate an efficacy of X, a specific. These studies require the participation of a high number of patients.
I mean, like a phase one trial, you could probably have 20 or 25 patients just to see is there.
In phase one, you mean?
Phase one.
Yeah, yeah.
And then phase two, then you had to start getting, a few hundred
patients. A few hundred.
And then phase three, when you're looking at that, you know, you start looking at thousands of patients. So it's important, you know, for patients to know that, you know, we need your participation.
Exactly.
To be able to, you know, to do the things that we do.
Collaboration with patients is really, really significant for us. And just to, at the end, all of them help to other patients, like them to...
Right. And I think that's the whole thing, is that the patient can oftentimes, they understand that maybe this drug or this test won't benefit me, but it could benefit somebody else
down the
road. And that's the thing that's good. We'll be back for some closing comments right after this.
Thank you.
And that was Tailgate with Patrick Lamb. We're here with Dr. Mercedes Marin Aguilera, and obviously Dr. Mellado has been stuck in a meeting in I think she's in Madrid or somewhere. Yeah, so that she couldn't join us on the phone, but we will have her here soon so that we can get the benefit of hers. But I really appreciate what Dr. Mercedes has brought to us. It's been excellent. Now, we talked a little bit earlier on about the role of women, the participation of women in sciences. Why do you think that it's been easier or more prevalent for women to be in sciences here, say, than compared to the U.S.?
Well, here, the main being involved in science for women is not a big deal, but however, there is a period of that of maximal production productivity in results, and that and there is not it has not been taken into account in comparison with men, because this period of maximal production overlaps with the period of maternity. Usually overlaps with this period. So in this period of life is women who mostly dedicate to take care of their of the family, and so it makes her to have a disadvantage in terms of a competition of a job position or for a grant. And these periods of low production because of familiar
it takes away from the opportunity to grow in the career and be able to do things. You don't publish as much.
Exactly.
You're not doing as
and
much.
And this is not taken account when there is a competitive position, you know, and there must be more regulations about that. There are improvements to perform just to improve the gender equality.
Because what you're doing is you're forcing the woman to say either my family or my career.
Exactly. And it should be shared in a family. So I think the main responsibility of this nice period is not only from women.
It's true. Now, obviously, our readers, our listeners have heard a lot about research. If they want to get more involved in some of the programs and studies that are happening at Hospital Clinic, how can they do it?
Well, you can contact directly by email, of course. Dr. Mellado and me, we will really pleased to inform you about everything. And we have a webpage, edipaps.org. Also, it can be accessed through the hospital clinic website. And there there is a lot of information about the different groups that are doing research at the hospital clinic. We also are, well, our institution is working on improving this webpage with more detailed information. Also, you can follow us at Twitter. All of the researchers in our group, and also Dr. Alex Pratt, who is the leader, has a Twitter account, and we try to update about the new results on
Excellent.
Cancer Research File.
Fantastic. Well, we again thank you for coming on, and we're going to leave you today with song by a performer who left us all too soon, Pino Daniele, and reminding us all we need to love and have a great wish for ourselves. See you, Barcelona. Talk to you next week.
Se mi guardi con gli occhi dell'amore, non ci lasceremo più. Inganneremo il tempo ed il dolore, sia l'estate che l'inverno. E cambieremo il mondo ogni volta che vuoi. E fermeremo il mondo ogni volta che vuoi, yeah. Perché non so che dire quando mi guardi così, non riesco mai a finire un discorso senza errori. Perché mi fai impazzire quando mi guardi così, mi sembra di capire che voglio solo te in questo mondo.
Se mi cerchi con gli occhi dell'amore, allora sì, mi troverai. Fra le parole semplici ed il sapore.